A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're cracking open a really influential book. It's practically an instruction manual for understanding why people say yes. We're diving into Robert Cialdini's Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion.
Yeah, this one's a classic. And it's not just about, you know, sales tactics or anything like that. It goes deeper. Cialdini really breaks down persuasion into these like six core psychological mechanisms, these things that just drive us to comply.
Exactly. And it's so relevant for, well, for all of us navigating this crazy information-packed world, isn't it? We use mental shortcuts constantly just to get through the day.
We have to, yeah.
And this book, it pulls back the curtain on those shortcuts, shows how they work, but also how they can be exploited. So the goal today is really to help you spot these things, make more conscious choices instead of just reacting automatically.
So let's talk about the guy behind it, Robert Cialdini. He's a big name, renowned social psychologist, professor emeritus, basically the global expert on influence.
Right. He's got all the academic chops. But what makes his work on this book really stand out is how he researched it. It wasn't just lab coats and surveys.
No, not at all. This is the fascinating part. He spent 3 years, 3 years going undercover.
Undercover. Doing what?
He worked as a trainee in all sorts of compliance jobs. Think of used car sales, fundraising for charities, high-pressure telemarketing gigs.
Wow. So he was a participant observer, like right in the trenches.
Exactly. He wasn't just watching. He was learning the techniques from the people who use them every single day to make a living. He saw it all firsthand.
That just gives it so much credibility, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You've got the rigorous academic side, but also this gritty real-world experience. He knows the theory and the practice.
And that unique perspective really shapes the whole book. His central idea revolves around these automatic responses we have. He calls it the click-whir response.
Ah, yes, the click-whir. It's such a memorable idea. Explain that a bit.
Okay, so imagine like a tape recorder in your brain. The click is a specific trigger out in the world, something someone says or does. And the whir is the pre-programmed behavior that automatically starts playing in response.
Without even thinking about it, really.
Precisely. It bypasses conscious thought, like the shortcut expensive equals good. That's a common one. The high price is the click, and assuming quality is the whir.
Gotcha. So the book is basically Cialdini mapping out the biggest, most reliable click triggers that set off our whir responses.
That's it. And he presents it in a really interesting way. It's partly a guide for people who want to persuade ethically, you know, in business or marketing. But maybe more importantly for us, it's a defense manual.
A defense manual for consumers.
Yeah, against manipulation.
Yeah.
To help us recognize when our automatic whir is being triggered unfairly.
Okay, so what are these big triggers, these principles?
He lays out six universal principles: reciprocity, commitment and consistency, social proof, liking, authority, and scarcity.
Right. Let's maybe tackle the first two. Reciprocity and consistency seem like a good place to start. They feel quite internal somehow.
Definitely. Reciprocity. This one is huge. It's that incredibly powerful social rule that says we have to repay what another person has provided us. Favors, gifts, concessions.
Even if we didn't ask for the gift in the first place.
Especially then. That's the key. Cialdini talks about the Hare Krishna Society back in the day. They'd give people an unsolicited flower at the airport, just hand it to you.
Ah, I remember hearing about that.
Well, the moment you took that flower, click, the reciprocity rule kicked in. You felt indebted. So when they then asked for a donation, it was much, much harder to say no.
Because you owed them something. And even for a flower you might not have wanted.
Exactly. And this feeling is exploited really cleverly in what Cialdini calls the door in the face technique.
Door in the face. Sounds dramatic.
It is, kind of. You start by making a really big request, something you know the other person will probably refuse. Like asking a friend to help you move house all weekend.
Yeah, unlikely they'll say yes to that immediately.
Right. So they say no, they shut the door in your face, metaphorically. Then you immediately follow up with your real smaller request. Okay, well, could you maybe just help for an hour on Saturday morning?
Ah, I see. Because you retreated from the big request, you made a concession.
Exactly. And now they feel this pressure to reciprocate your concession by agreeing to the smaller, more reasonable request. It works surprisingly often.
Okay, that's reciprocity. It's this external sense of obligation. How does commitment and consistency fit in?
Well, this one's more about internal pressure. Once we've made a choice or taken a stand, especially publicly, We feel this powerful need to behave consistently with that commitment.
We want our actions to match our words and beliefs, to look consistent.
Yes, both to others and importantly to ourselves. And small initial commitments can pave the way for much larger ones later on.
Cialdini mentioned some conditions that make commitments stick more, doesn't he?
He does. Mm. They're most powerful when they are active, like writing something down versus just thinking it, public, telling others, effortful, requiring real work, and seen as internally motivated, not forced.
And he uses a pretty chilling example from history, right? The Chinese captors and American POWs in the Korean War.
Yeah, it's a stark illustration. Instead of just using brute force, they started small. They'd ask prisoners to make very minor anti-American or pro-communist statements, maybe just copying something down.
Seems harmless enough on the surface.
But it was active. It was written. It started a tiny shift. Then they'd gradually escalate the requests, write an essay, participate in discussion groups. Because the prisoners had already made those initial small commitments, they felt compelled to stay consistent, leading some down a path of collaboration they'd never have imagined. It fundamentally altered their self-image.
Wow. That really shows the power of wanting to appear consistent, even when it leads you somewhere unexpected. Okay, so if that's about internal alignment, what about looking outwards? That brings us to social proof, right?
Exactly. So social proof is all about figuring out what's correct by finding out what other people think is correct.
The herd mentality. If everyone's doing it, it must be the right thing to do.
Pretty much. And it's strongest when we're feeling uncertain or when the people we see acting are similar to us. We think, hey, people like me are doing this, so maybe I should too.
But this can go wrong, can it? Like the bystander effect.
Absolutely. The famous Kitty Genovese case is a tragic example Cialdini discusses. Multiple people witnessed an attack, but nobody intervened quickly. Why? Pluralistic ignorance.
Explain that.
Well, the situation was ambiguous, maybe confusing. So everyone looked to the other bystanders to gauge how serious it was. But because everyone else was also looking around, appearing calm, nobody acted decisively.
So the social proof was telling everyone that inaction was the appropriate response.
Sadly, yes. Everyone assumed someone else must know more, or that it wasn't a real emergency because nobody else was freaking out, a deadly loop of inaction.
Chilling. Okay, besides looking to the crowd, we also look up, right? To authority.
Oh, definitely. We have this deep-seated sense of duty to authority. It's hammered into us from childhood. Obey parents, teachers, police officers. Historically, it helps societies function.
But Cialdini points out that we don't just obey actual authority, but the mere symbols of authority.
That's the kicker. Things like titles, doctor, professor, uniforms, even a security guard's uniform can trigger compliance. And trappings like expensive suits or fancy cars.
Even if that authority has no relevant expertise in the situation.
Often, yes. The symbols alone are enough to flip that switch, that click or response of deference. We just assume they know what they're doing.
And the classic experiment here is Milgram, isn't it?
The Milgram experiment. It's still shocking today. Ordinary people were instructed by someone in a lab coat, an authority figure, to administer what they believed were increasingly painful electric shocks to another person.
And many of them did, even when they were clearly distressed about it.
Yes, simply because the authority figure calmly told them to continue. It just shows the overwhelming power of perceived authority to override our own moral judgments. Frightening stuff.
It really is. Okay, let's move to the last two principles. Liking feels simpler. We just do things for people we like.
It seems simple, but Cialdini shows how easily liking can be manufactured and manipulated. Of course, we're more likely to say yes to someone we know and like.
So what makes us like someone, according to the research?
Several things. Physical attractiveness, like it or not. Good-looking people have an advantage. Similarity, we like people who are like us in terms of opinions, background, even dress style. Compliments, flattery works, even when we suspect it might not be entirely sincere.
Huh.
And cooperation, working together towards a common goal, builds liking and rapport. Also, mere association. If someone is associated with good things, we tend to like them more.
And the classic example Cialdini uses is the Tupperware party.
Oh, the Tupperware party is a masterclass. It blends so many principles. The request to buy doesn't come from a stranger. It comes from your friend, the host that's liking.
Right. You want to support your friend.
Then there are games with prizes that taps into reciprocity. You see your other friends buying stuff that's social proof. It creates this environment where saying no feels really difficult and socially awkward.
A compliance powerhouse built on friendship. Okay, last one. Scarcity. The idea that we want what we can't have.
Yeah, pretty much. Opportunities just seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. Think limited time offer or only three left in stock.
Why is that so powerful?
It triggers something Cialdini calls psychological reactance. We hate losing freedoms. When something becomes less available, our freedom to have it is threatened, and we react by wanting it even more.
So the fear of missing out, FOMO, combined with this reactance thing.
Exactly. The thought of losing out is often a stronger motivator than the thought of gaining something of equal value. We're wired to protect against loss.
Cialdini mentions the Romeo and Juliet effect here too, doesn't he?
Yes. Parental opposition to a teenage romance often backfires spectacularly. Why? Because the opposition creates scarcity, limits the couple's freedom and time together.
Which just makes them desire each other more intensely, the forbidden fruit effect.
Precisely. The scarcity created by the obstacle makes the relationship seem even more precious and worth fighting for.
Okay, wow. That covers the six principles. Let's try and pull back a bit. Mm. What are the big overarching themes here? For me, it's definitely this double-edged sword idea about mental shortcuts.
Yeah, that's crucial. These heuristics, these shortcuts, like social proof is usually right or reciprocate favors, they're essential. We couldn't function without them. We'd be paralyzed by analysis.
Wow.
But they also open the door to manipulation. They create blind spots. Cialdini isn't saying become a cynic who trusts nothing. It's about developing intelligent discrimination.
Knowing when the shortcut is likely reliable and when it might be being used against you, like spotting fake scarcity cues.
Exactly. And it makes you think, doesn't it? How often are you operating on autopilot during the day? Claiming buy now, agreeing to something small. This book kind of wakes you up to that.
It really does. Another key theme seems to be the difference between ethical influence and outright manipulation.
Right. The principles themselves aren't inherently bad. Using reciprocity by genuinely doing someone a good turn is fine. Using authority because you are a genuine expert is fine.
But manipulation comes in when you fake the trigger.
That's the core difference. Faking similarity to build liking, creating false scarcity, pretending authority you don't have, that's crossing the line into unethical territory. It's about authenticity.
And maybe a final theme is just how deep-rooted this stuff is. It's evolutionary, isn't it?
Totally. Reciprocity helped build stable social groups. Deferring to authority helped maintain order. Following the crowd often kept you safe. These things worked for survival for millennia.
Which explains why they're so powerful and universal across different cultures. They're part of our shared human software.
Well put. Okay, the book also has some really quotable lines that capture these ideas.
Yeah, like that core concept of the automatic response. Click whir. The sound of the sequence is almost mechanical. It just perfectly sums up that mindless reaction.
Mm. And the warning about social proof is pretty sharp. We're all think alike. No one thinks very much. A good reminder not to just follow the herd off a cliff.
Definitely. And for scarcity, that line, the way to love anything is to realize that it might be lost. That hits home, doesn't it? Explains why we value things more when they're threatened.
It really does. And maybe one more related to that defense idea we talked about, the goal being intelligent discrimination. Knowing when to trust your gut reaction, your fur, and when to stop and think critically.
Okay, so let's bring this right down to earth.
Yeah.
How can you, the listener, use this stuff in everyday life? Let's start with just being a consumer.
The big defensive strategy is simply to pause. Especially when you feel that sudden rush of desire or obligation, usually from scarcity or reciprocity tactics.
Like when a salesperson says, this is the last one, or gives you a free gift.
Exactly. Step back mentally for a second. Ask yourself, forget the tactic for a moment. Do I actually want this product or service for its own merits? If it wasn't scarce, or if I didn't feel I owed this person, would I still buy it? Separating the trigger from the item itself is key.
That's great advice. What about using these principles ethically, say, in a professional setting?
Well, take commitment and consistency. A manager wanting genuine buy-in for a new process shouldn't just announce it.
Right, because that feels forced.
Instead, involve the team in developing the process. Get their active input, make their contributions public. When people feel they've helped create something, they're far more committed to making it work because their actions need to be consistent with that earlier voluntary involvement.
Makes sense. And in negotiation, you mentioned the door in the face.
Right, the rejection then retreat. You can use that ethically. Start by asking for something a bit more than you realistically expect to get, a slightly higher salary, a slightly bigger project scope.
Knowing it might get rejected.
Possibly. Then when you retreat to your actual more reasonable goal, it comes across as a concession. The other party feels a psychological nudge to reciprocate your concession by meeting you at that more reasonable point. It can make reaching agreement smoother.
Interesting. Okay, as we wrap up, what was the most surprising or impactful thing for you from this deep dive?
For me, I think it's just how easily the liking principle can be triggered. Finding even trivial similarities, offering simple compliments, it seems almost too basic, but the research shows it really lowers people's guard. It's a bit unsettling how quickly rapport can be, well, faked.
Yeah, I agree with that. My main takeaway is feeling like I've got, I don't know, x-ray specs for social situations now. You start seeing these principles playing out everywhere, all the time. The ultimate goal isn't to be suspicious of everyone, but to move from being sort of passively influenced to being a more active, conscious chooser.
Well said. And here's a final thought to leave you with. Think about social media. How are these six principles being amplified, even weaponized, by algorithms every single day?
Oh, well, yeah. Personalized ads hitting your liking triggers, celebrity endorsements using authority, trending topics leveraging social proof, flash sales using scarcity.
Exactly. It's all there, constantly refining ways to make you click, share, buy. So how does knowing about Cialdini's principles change how you might scroll through your feed later today? Something to think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.